Hello, everyone. Welcome to this special edition of Talking Logistics on LinkedIn. We're trying something new here today. I'm streaming this episode on LinkedIn so that you can post your questions and share your perspective on today's topic, which is rethinking business relationships in supply chain management. And my guest today is Kate Vitasic, who is a member of the graduate and executive education faculty at the University of Tennessee. She is also the architect of the Vested Business Model, a popular keynote speaker, and the author of several books on Vested, including her latest book, which I have right here, which is Preventing the Dispute Before It Begins: Proven Mechanisms for Fostering Better Business Relationships. So I still haven't read it all. I'm still at the beginning phases, but just like her other books in my library, and in fact, I think if you look back here, I realize this, there's Getting to We there. You can't fully see it, but I have it there, and I have the Vested ones elsewhere. It's a great book, and I'm enjoying it so far, and I think it's a great addition to the overall, which you can see there behind Kate. I'm sure we'll get into bits and pieces of each of these books throughout our conversation today. Now, I've known Kate for more than 15 years, going back to when she published her first book on Vested business relationships and launched the Vested course at the University of Tennessee, where I was one of the first students in that very first, pilot class. And we've kept in touch all this time, and I've followed her work, and I've been a big fan of the work, and she and her colleagues have been doing all this time. Kate's also been on Talking Logistics several times over the years, and it's great to welcome, her back to the program. Before we dive into the conversation, a quick housekeeping note. Since I don't have a producer that can feed me, questions from the audience in real time, and I'm just not talented enough to stay engaged with Kate and kind of fish through all the comments to find some good audience questions, I encourage all of you to post your questions there in the LinkedIn discussion thread. But Kate and I are going to respond to them after the episode is all over and keep the conversation going, via that discussion thread. All right, so with all that, Kate, welcome back to Talking Logistics.
Well, welcome and thanks for having me. I'm excited. It's been a while.
Absolutely. I think it's been at least a few years. So it's great to have you back. And I made a bet with myself that about $1 million that you would be wearing orange today, and I won.
Awesome. I hope you're paying yourself because I don't want to pay that bet. And yes, orange is the color of the University of Tennessee, but it's also the color of change. And every day, that's what I try to do is challenge people to do, change the way they think about their strategic relationships. We say we have a strategic partner, and then we turn around and, write these contracts that are very traditional and transactional.
Absolutely. So we're going to unpack, some of that. But again, I always say to myself, if I see someone in orange at an industry conference, more than likely it's going to be Kate. So I got to make sure I go up to you and say hello. So as maybe as a way to get started, I mean, we have a lot of, I have a lot of questions that I want to get through. But maybe for those in the audience who are unfamiliar with Vested, let's start there. I mean, can you give a quick overview of what it is and why is it relevant for supply chain executives?
Well, Vested is a methodology that came out of our research. So, the University of Tennessee is number one in the world in supply chain management, graduate and executive education. And we were fortunate enough to have a lot of funded research. And one of those funded research questions out of the Department of Defense and Air Force was how do you create better strategic relationships, right? So if you're buying a weapon system or you have, you've bought a GE engine and you're kind of locked in to them doing the maintenance and it doesn't feel real good. So you have this like, two 800-pound gorillas going at each other. And so I had the opportunity to study complex outsourcing initiatives, buyer-supplier relationships, what was working well, what wasn't working well. And what was working well is that the best really focused on the relationship. And we get that term vested because I have a vested interest in your success. You have a vested interest in my success. It really is a true win-win relationship. And what happens is most of the time we have this buy-sell. We have a trade-off and a concession. It's like you're pulling tug-of-war against each other. And so, we got to study some of the world's most successful relationships and look at trends. And that's what we found is there's five simple rules. And so Vested is a methodology, It's first and foremost a mindset, because you have to change your mind in your frame of mind to create a win-win relationship. But then once you've said you want to go down that path, it's a methodology that, when applied, creates an outcome-based business model with a formal relational contract.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, part of the reason that I was very interested in this work and what brought me to, you know, your work and to attend that, you know, first Vested course at the University of Tennessee is, you know, as an industry analyst, at that time and still through today, I focused a lot on 3PL shipper relationships, right? And those are, you know, it's one of those classic, you know, transaction based, you know, they, you know, shippers can, you know, cancel a contract at any time, you know, certainly this was the case, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and arguably still in some cases today, very transactional oriented. So it was the classic, to use some of the terminology that you've used in some of your books. It was very much, you know, what's in it for me type of relationship, in terms of looking at it from a what's in it for we type of relationship. So that brings me to my next question. I mean, I think I saw, you know, some of those challenges with 3PL shipper relationships back then, and still to in some extent to today. So what are some of the biggest challenges in traditional business relationships, whether they're supplier, customer, 3PL, you know, shipper, that ultimately led you to, you know, develop this vested model?
Well, I think that you use the word transactional. That's really at the heart of it. When we have a transactional business model, every dollar, every unit, every shipment, every pallet, and the supplier is rewarded for doing transactions, why would they want to be more efficient if they get paid per transaction? So I collect these little war stories, but I went into a warehouse once, a third-party logistics provider, and I was like, oh, interesting. These look like some older calendars. You're just kind of doing the tour, and you're like, this is a 3-year-old calendar. Oh, next door, next pallet over is a 7-year-old calendar. And I was like, oh, help me understand this. Why do we have these old calendars? Like, well, we've tried to tell them that they should scrap it, but it's we get paid, X dollars an hour, X dollars a pallet, so it's not our job, it's their inventory. And I'm like, oh, it kills you, right? But then I kind of don't blame the supplier, because one, they've been, pushed for every penny. And if they can figure out how to make up money within the rules of the contract, why not? It's not that they're evil. Your customer's been beating on you, and you're like, hey, you've opened a door here. I've got a way to recoup something. But also, I think there's a lot of apathy, and that we have a lot of functional siloism. I don't know if you know this, but I was a buyer. I used to work at Microsoft. I've been on the buy side of outsourcing as well as on the supply side. So I worked for Microsoft's largest supplier. And as a supplier, we would often raise our hand like, this isn't working right. This could be better. Well, that's the marketing department. Oh, this is that department. Oh, that's not, and you're just like, it's demoralizing. And after a while, you just quit raising your hand and go, all right, well, it's just status quo. Let's just do status quo. So the transactional mindset really has created a world of buy sell. And we've perfected the art of buying, and we've perfected the art of selling, and our interests don't align. That's where we get the word vested. We now, instead of tugging against each other, I want to take the supplier, put them on the same side as me, right? And put our business problem over here and tug together against that business problem. So we're working together to create value versus just exchange value, and definitely not extract value.
Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, I think in some of your books, you've highlighted a number of different, you know, examples of perverted, you know, these incentives, right? That, you know, I think the classic one I think many people have heard of is the one about the, you know, the rats, right? About that town that was overrun by rats, so the government decided to pay people for every rat that they killed. But so then what people started doing, well, they started raising rats, right? Because it was going to pay them, right? And I think, you know, some of these examples that you highlight, you know, if you really look at some of these contracts, you really are creating these perverted incentives without even perhaps, you know, consciously, you know, recognizing it. And ultimately, you know, in the world of supply chain logistics, that ends up with, you know, added waste, added inventory, added costs, and so forth, because you have these misaligned, incentives between the two parties. You've worked with a lot of different companies, a lot of different industries, a lot of different relationship types, and so it's been over now 15 years for sure, that you've been on this vested journey. I mean, I guess the simplest question is, where are we today compared to 15 years ago? I assume that we've seen some progress along the way, thanks to your work and those of your colleagues. So what progress has been made, particularly in transforming supply chain logistics business relationships, and maybe what hurdles still remain?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You were in that inaugural class. It was a pilot. We just kind of put it out there and said, here's our research and here's what we're thinking. What do you guys think as experts? And, since, we started with no one doing vested, it was an idea. It literally was an idea. And we tossed it out to the world. We wrote a book about it. The first book, 2010, Vested Outsourcing, 5 Rules That Will Transform Outsourcing. Today, we have a whole over 150 deals that have used the vested methodology. One company has 6 vested deals. And so, it's companies coming in and saying, maybe, just maybe, I'm stuck, right? I've outsourced and then I switched the supplier logo and I'm still getting the same results because our suppliers, many suppliers are capable. And we've commoditized, and I would actually argue over-commoditized. So the first company that actually piloted a vested deal was Intel, down in Costa Rica. And I got a call from Todd Shire. We have a case study on this. We try to get case studies as much as possible. We have 25 case studies today. And Todd called, and he was the head of procurement for transportation and logistics. He said, I've got a problem in Costa Rica. DHL's monopoly. They're the only game in town, and we like to win. And Intel, we like to win, and we're not winning, and it's really making us mad. And he goes, I need to change the game, right? And that's, I think, what we do is we get into this, win-lose. The more power we have, the more we want to use our power. The more leverage we have, we've been taught to commoditize. A supplier is, apples to apples to apples to apples. Well, when we commoditize, we often fall in the trap of over-commoditizing, and then we're actually not creating value, right? Maybe if we worked differently with one. So they piloted vested in Costa Rica with DHL. It was wildly successful. And it's interesting because in the case study, they talk about, it was like, well, it was only successful because, DHL must have been overcharging us because they were the monopoly, right? And so then they piloted again in the Netherlands. And they're like, okay, wow, that's interesting. That really worked. And then they piloted again. And so I'm actually working on my third case study now with Intel. But it's not the norm. It's a company that has power. It's very hard for, or it, not just a company, a person. A person has power. A person within a company. Companies have the power. The more power we have, we tend to accidentally use or abuse our power, or intentionally. And I would argue, you actually said, when you talked about perverse incentives, a lot of times this is actually unintentional consequences, right? So, I say I have a strategic partnership, we've got a great relationship with the supplier, and yet our legal team has this standard terms and conditions that has something called a 60-day termination for convenience. So I could have all the intent to create value with my supplier, but if the market shifts and then I can, there's nothing compelling me that I have to work with that supplier. Here's somebody that can give me, something for 2 cents cheaper a mile. I'm going to switch. Well, we forget that the suppliers made investments. And if they get hosed on the return on investments, they're going to come back and get it back. So it's almost like we're playing whack-a-mole. We whack, and then the problem just, is popping up other places. Instead of slowing down, taking a step back and saying, how can we actually collaborate to optimize our supply chain? So I think the one thing I would like to encourage people to do is don't buy and sell, optimize. Find a partner that can optimize. And when you create that value and share that value, you're going to create so much more value than if you got into a buy sell. transaction-based deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, I think as you were talking, I was remembering back, one of the going back to the 3PL customer relationships. I mean, for a long time, one of the key areas that a lot of customers had with the 3PLs was they're not investing enough in technology. They're not investing enough in technology, right? And but I would talk to the 3PLs and they said, we would love to invest in technology, but and of course, this is before the days of cloud technology and everything else. But if we're going to invest in technology, implement a TMS or a WMS, you're talking about literally almost millions of dollars that we could potentially put in place for this customer. But they can exit the relationship in 60 days for convenience. That's a huge risk for us. So there is that kind of that tension where. The customer wants this and they're expecting their 3PLs to move up the maturity curve with technology, but the 3PLs would love to and want to be more strategic with the customers, but we're not going to invest millions of dollars, and particularly in a low margin business, relatively speaking, if you can turn around, and pull the business from us, a year from now, right? Because somebody's offering, like you said, a few cents cheaper per storage, or a few cents cheaper per mile on transportation. So I think that's kind of a real world, example. And the other thing you talked about, I mean, I think why it's so hard, and I've heard this all along, it's, and you brought it up earlier, it's truly a mindset, right? Because we're so used to, I remember when I was in college, you would take like a negotiations class, and it was always about winning, right? It was always about how do you position yourself the best to get what you want out of that negotiation, right? And it was more about, in many cases, it was very adversarial, right? Yeah, there was some talk about, making sure the other party is also happy at the end of the day, but really, if you read between the lines, it was about, how do you position yourself in a way to quote unquote win? So it was that emphasis on win versus, creating lasting value, with each other. And I want to explore the topic you raised about kind of leveraging the power that you might have either as an individual or a company. But before we get there, I mean, you just shared a great example there with Intel and DHL and some of the pilots that they've done. Are there any other examples? Maybe a case study that I think that you think illustrates, maybe it's not even in supply chain logistics or somewhere else, that you think is the best example of a success story. I mean, what led the two parties to come together, and what are the kind of illustrate the key characteristics of a successful vested relationship?
Yeah, so we actually have 25 formal case studies. Each of our case studies are between 20 and 55 pages. So we really go into detail about them. And there's about another 36 companies who've been public about what they've done. IBM and Securitas, for example, have a podcast talking about why they've, after, I think it's over 10 years of doing business together, they said, we need to do business differently. Right. But one of my most recent case studies is EY, the consulting company EY. And so, they really want to try to retain and attract the best talent. They're hiring these young consultants to come in. And so they want to have a really great workplace experience. Right. And so think about what goes into a workplace. You've got the building, but you have, you forgot your cord. Something's wrong with your phone and it's not syncing right. Right. And so you've got, one of the ideas that they created was a tech ops lobby. And so how can the supplier, a service-oriented supplier, come in and help do that? And this was interesting because it wasn't just a, it was their facilities management supplier, dining, cleaning, right? And so if you think about workplace services, they're like, I could think differently about this. So if we track that case study, they'd been outsourcing for quite some time. So it wasn't new. And so each evolution they did, they got a little bit more strategic. And each one, they got more strategic. They used their power. Wow, I'm going to go from this many suppliers to this many. And then I'm going to, create a performance-based agreement. And so you could track that evolution of them being more strategic. And then finally, they said, you know what? We say strategic and we've had some benefits, but we're not creating value. And that's when they used one of the tools in our toolkits called a request for partner. So they put it out to the two main suppliers they worked with. and as a pilot in the Nordics. So they have 125 locations in the Nordics across four countries. And I said, all right, you two suppliers, you're our main suppliers. I want to just see how we can think differently. And so they invited the suppliers to come in and say, you know, you get a magic wand, what would this look like? How could we work differently together? They wound up picking ISS, which is a Danish-based company. If you've never heard of them, they have, I think, 350,000 employees. You just might not have heard of them if you're in the US, but they are huge facilities management, workplace services, outsourced, you know, dining, cleaning, maintenance kind of stuff. And so they had already worked with them for many years. And so now, working with them in a different way, following the five rules of Vested, you start to see, instead of exchanging value, creating value. And this tech lobby was one of those. So I use the analogy of a pony, right? So a pony is a little initiative, a big initiative, those innovations that we want. It could be technology, it could just be a process improvement. And so the employees are challenged to come up with ponies, and the supplier is rewarded for creating value. So there's incentives. Instead of a price, we have a pricing model. So if costs go down, supplier makes more profit, right? If service goes up, supplier makes more profit. So you're pegging the value that's created to the supplier's profitability. You know, a second rule of Vested is that you focus on the what, not the how. So instead of giving that supplier a detailed statement of work, you know, you're just the cleaner, go do it this way. This is the way it's always been done. The suppliers now get to challenge the work. And so, how could you do things better, faster, cheaper, safer, more sustainable? And so, one of the ideas that came out of that is like, you know what? Employees are frustrated when they have to go to the IT department because they lost a cord. And so if ISS is the hospitality, they do the front-end hospitality, the reception and all that, and you know, they're used to welcoming people, making them happy. They said, you know, why don't we create a tech ops lobby with kind of the, you know, instead of the front desk, you know, you sign in as a visitor, it's you sign in and you come and see us at the tech ops. And so with a little bit of light touch training, 80% of the tech problems can be solved by a hospitality person. The cost difference between, oh, I have to go to the IT department, they're busy, they may not be the most, you know, friendly hospitality kind of people. So you can take and rethink how they were doing 80% of their interfaces with their employees to create a tech ops lobby. You know, the sensors, looking at how they optimize the buildings, unbelievable results. And so cost went down significantly. All aspects of service went up. Employee satisfaction went up, both from the people, the EY employees who work in those buildings, but also from the ISS employees. You know, interesting metric that you have a lot of these hospitality type of companies do is a net promoter score, because there's a lot of turnover in that space. Do you really want to be a cleaner? Really? Dining person? Not the coolest, most well-paid job, right? And so if you do a net promoter score in that industry, it's pretty low. High turnover, people don't love those jobs. And ISS does a net promoter score for all of their customer accounts, all of their outsourcing accounts, and they have thousands of outsource accounts. So the average net promoter score is 20. Again, no one really likes these jobs, right? It went up to 58. People love working on the EY account. Why? Because they're not just the cleaner, right? They're the floor captain who's taking care of the employees, who gets to come up with ideas. They're creating value. And so they really have better engagement. You know, their employees are happy. That rubs off on the EY employees, you know, and it's, you've got a much better place that's radically more efficient. Radical performance improvements, you know, double-digit cost savings, and you know, much, much higher profit from the supplier. And that's what we want to do, is we want to challenge people not just to buy and sell, you know, exchange value, but how can we collaborate to create value with five rules? You know, and the rules are really that methodology that we researched and came up with that you sat in that class in 2010. saying, hey, there's a different way. But unfortunately, the rules are different than what we normally do. I talked about rule two, focus on the what, not the how. We don't have a statement of work. So if you have a dogma and a process that here's my statement of work, oh, I have to let that go, right? Because your supplier is the expert. They need to write how the work's been done. They need to rewrite how it's been done because they are the experts. And so it is change. And that's one thing, you ask what the difference is. Well, 150 companies doing vested deals, or 150 different initiatives. There's more companies than that because it takes two to tango, right? So it takes a buyer and a supplier. So huge success on that. 600, was just doing the math on this. 636 companies have sent over 11,000 people to that class, to our classes.
Wow.
So you are seeing people come and trying to change. But unfortunately, people come and IBM was one of these. We had IBM came in 2013 and they said, wow, Kate, that's different. I don't know. It's tough. That's really different, But now, 2025, they're on a podcast talking about why they needed to challenge the status quo. 10 years later, they're going, that stuff I learned, maybe just maybe I'm ready now to do
Wow.
that.
Yeah, I know it's a,
Exciting,
that's
super
very
exciting.
exciting. I mean, I think that there's so much to unpack there. I mean, first of all, one of the things you said early on, which I actually wrote a blog post many years ago quoting you, was the, we talk so much in this industry, particularly on the technology side, right, about sending out requests for proposals, right? RFPs, RFPs, RFPs. But I love the whole request for partner, right? I think that changes right there immediately. You're thinking differently when you're putting together a request for partner, right? And what does it mean to you if you're putting that document together? What does a partner mean to you, right? And why do you want a partner versus a request for a proposal? Okay, this is what we want, right? And what you're going to be your cost and so forth. So that right there, I think when you that simple changing of the phrase or change using that acronym but changing the words, I think is very powerful in my mind.
But you don't just change the word, the process is different too, because now I'm not writing the spec for you to bid on. Now I'm telling you my problem. Hey, here's my problem. Here's the data. What data do you need? So let's go look at my problem, and then you come and together we figure out how we can optimize that. So I like to use this an analogy in a request for partner. If the it's like a cocktail, if the buyer is the vodka, the alcohol, supplier A is grapefruit, supplier B is orange juice, and supplier C is cranberry, you get different solutions. So by not commoditizing, you can actually bring out the best in those suppliers. So you're opening it up to the art of the possible. And the reason why I like that EY case study so much is because they had the evolution of outsourcing. This wasn't a first generation problem. They'd gone through, they changed the logos on the service providers. They'd seen all the problems that happen and all the goodness that happens from outsourcing. And they said, you know what? The problem is how we outsource. It's transactional. And so you could see how that problem evolved. You can see their evaluation. They did what was called a deal review to look at their contract, where they had weaknesses, where they had perverse incentives. And you could see the request for partner that they went through. They talked about the criteria that they used, how that process works. And then they talked about, creating the vested agreement and following the rules. So it's a really good case study because it isn't just about the vested and the five rules, but it's their entire journey of outsourcing from the earliest days to now where they are, and that epiphany that, we could just outsource this again and use competitive tension, but we're not going to get the value that we want out of these relationships.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, kind of to build on that, I mean, I think the other thing that I got out of it and it's part of the work is really that focusing on those desired outcomes, right? So it's not on, what is it you're trying to achieve? And it's always funny because I would always hear like 3PL say, you're outsourcing, you're looking to outsource for a reason because either you don't have, the internal expertise or the capabilities internally. So why are you dictating to us how we should do it? We should be able to come up with, leverage our own human IP, our own systems, and so forth to put together a proposal or an approach that we think is creative and is going to be a win-win, versus being told exactly how to do it. I mean, there's if you know how to do it exactly, then it becomes just like a labor thing. Maybe you're just outsourcing it because you think we have cheaper labor, but you're not really letting us be creative and bring forth perhaps new ideas and new innovation, to this, because you only know what you know, and if only, the only thing you know internally is what you've always done, then you're just going to outsource what you've always done, and you're not really creating any new, value there. I'll probably table this question, but it might be the other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about the mindset. And maybe you can quickly comment on it because I want to get to my next question. But I'm wondering if, as millennials and Gen Z folks are coming into now the workforce. I mean, they've been in the workforce for a while, but you're having this churn where the baby boomers and the Gen Xers like myself, are maybe on the way out. Are you seeing that maybe there's a generational impact to kind of be more open perhaps to a vested model of thinking differently or approaching the work differently?
Yeah, actually I am, but I have to tell you a fun thing. So when you talked about, being frustrated, the suppliers are frustrated. We call this the outsourcing paradox. You outsource to the expert and then tell them how to do the work. It's nuts. It's craziness, right? But you're absolutely right. The younger generation is much more open-minded. So people who've done a job for a long time, it's actually called the curse of knowledge. It's got a couple other names too, but the more someone's an expert in something, the harder it is for them to change. There's a really fantastic video on YouTube called The Backwards Bicycle, and we get used to riding a bicycle and how all you do is change a gear and you're thinking, oh yeah, I just got to, your brain freaks out, right? And so the more that we've been doing our jobs, the better we are at being a procurement expert. The better we are at being a sales professional, the more we've gotten used to buying and selling. And so when we see younger folks, they'll often go, well, of course, this was, why wouldn't we be collaborating? This is the way we should. I don't want to be put in a box. You want me to do that? Like, I want to use my brain. And so you are seeing a more, much more openness with the next generation. And sometimes I laugh, you have to let the dinosaurs die. But you look at, say, IBM, who's gone on record, has a podcast, an article about making the shift to vested with Securitas. They used to think about Securitas security as man guards. Man guards, we buy man guards. How much is the man guard, right? And the chief security officer, is like, it is not about man guards. There is so much here. The technology that we could use, the way that we're doing things needs to be challenged. And the nice thing is, with, COVID, post-COVID, and all the dynamic nature of business, and things just aren't, there's a lot of pressure and tension on our supply chains today that we haven't had in the past. And I think people are willing to change, right? They're willing to go, all right, it's like EY. I've gone down this path and I'm my fourth generation of outsourcing. Maybe, just maybe, there's a better way. And the more you start to read about our work, it actually kind of gets addictive. You go, wow, that's rich. Oh, interesting. Oh, that's how the contract works. Oh, that's how the bid process could work. And it really opens your mind to a different way of working that we're just not used to. And I tell people, it's not right or wrong. What you're doing works. You're gonna get a contract at the end of the day. But if it's not as optimal as you'd like, maybe, just maybe, pilot something else. And I always tell people, pilot, right? You don't have to change your policy, right? Just try it, like Intel. Just give it a pilot. They didn't change their procurement policy with all of their other 3PL accounts. They said, I got to do something different down here in Costa Rica because it's just not working out. And so then the more you pilot again, and then you pilot again, and they're like, it's actually working. Right. And we're working on another case study now with Intel on a quite a large deal, not released yet. So I can't talk about the details yet, but it should come out later this fall. And it was kind of their attempt to say, all right, Vested, we've done these little pilots. Let's do something in a big way and see if it works. And you have to challenge the status quo to do that.
Right. Well, I guess that goes back to the classic saying, right? You can't teach an old dog new tricks, right? So, but sometimes you have to learn the new tricks, or sometimes if you can't teach that old dog a new trick, teach a new one, and they're the next generation that's going to bring this forth within the organizations. Now, one of the things that's embedded in all these relationships is trust, which brings me to my next question. And the last time you were on Talking Logistics, you and our friend Carl Manrode from Georgia College talked about the importance of trust and business relationships, and we've actually done some work here, inspired by some of the work that you've done on this topic too, of trust, with our Indago supply chain research community. So in one of the surveys that we did last year, a supply chain executive commented, I'm just going to read here, I trust my suppliers to miss deadlines, my carriers to be delayed in transit, and IT to never give me what I need. I'm really pretty rarely surprised as a result. So obviously this was kind of a little sarcastic, a little tongue in cheek, but there's a lot, element of truth in it as well. So first of all, I mean, does this comment, surprise you? And is lack of trust between parties the biggest hurdle to creating, these more collaborative business relationships that we've been talking about? And if so, I mean, how can companies get over that trust hurdle?
Yeah, so this is actually something that Carl and I've been studying for over 10 years, actually. He developed it, and then we've kind of looked at it and piloted it and collaborated on this thing called a compatibility and trust assessment. And so when organizations are trying to decide to go down a path, they often go, well, I don't know, do I have enough trust? I don't trust them. And so we look at the perception gaps of trust because it's always the other guy. Right. And so you look at, well, how trusting are you? Oh, I have lots of focus. I communicate very well. I'm really transparent. But you're not so good. And so by sharing with each party that it's the other guy, well, then it's really both of you. Right. And then you have discussions. So the tool, the compatibility and trust assessment, opens the door for people to realize that they have trust gaps and it's not necessarily the other guy. And one of my favorite case studies we actually talk about in Harvard Business Review is Island Health. So it's a health authority in Canada, and they're doctors. And so they had, I think it was a trust score of like 40. It was horrible. And so at the end of it was really bad. And at the end of the compatibility trust assessment, we have people at we ask them to give three adjectives, and they get a little slider scale. Is that a positive adjective and a neutral adjective or a negative? 84% of the adjectives were negative, toxic, terrible, bullying. Ooh, right? Ooh. And so whose fault is it? The other guy. No, you created this lack of trust environment. And so then we talk about transparency. Opaque. Well, why are you opaque? What information could you use? How could, if information is power, information shared is exponential power. What should you be sharing? Why aren't you sharing? Right? And so you help people understand the power of choosing to trust, that it's, my behavior, maybe I had a distrusting behavior because you had a distrusting behavior. So you create this slippery slope, and then you look back and all of a sudden you're like, well, I didn't really want to be on that. Don't you want to have a trusting relationship? So why don't we create trusting behavior? So we do this thing called a statement of intent. People write down what trusting environment looks like. They have guiding principles, and they agree to follow those, and they agree to be transparent about the things that they agree they should be transparent about. It is game changing. I mean, seriously, we do this thing. It's an alignment workshop, and you come in and you start with this, and you challenge them to choose to trust, to create their statement of intent, to choose to be transparent. They walk out of that 3 days later, and it's night and day. And it stays that way, right? So we wrote about this in HBR, 18 months later, 86% of the adjectives were positive. Collaborative, trusting, transparent. Well, of course, you had to choose to trust. You had to create a trusting environment. And so I would tell people, if you don't have trust, turn around and look in the mirror. And then why not score? Why not do this simple, neutral third party? The University of Tennessee comes in. It's super easy. It's $2,500. The cost is split, and do a trust score and have a little trust discussion. And then the Dell case study, we also profile it in the HBR article. That's how they started. They started with the trust discussion. I don't know if I could trust you. All right. Should we be more transparent, right? So it's kind of like skinny dipping, right? And so sometimes having that outside facilitator to help you walk that through and help you look at it with a different lens and a different mindset is totally game changing.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first came upon that HBR article and read it, and we had the conversation on Talking Logistics. I mean, it struck me this was almost like a a marriage counseling tool, right, for business relationships. And I think the thing that struck me also is that when you talk about trust, it's not very, I think for a lot of people, it's not something that's very tangible. Like you either know or you don't know if you trust someone. And I think if you peel back the onion, you can then, like you said, through this tool, you can understand maybe why, what are the things that are the root causes of a lack of trust. But I think that was the other thing that I got out of way with, is that there is actually, this methodology you could actually measure, right? That there's you can make it tangible. You can actually measure, how trusting the relationship is, and you can identify those areas that are the root causes for lack of trust. So for our viewers, you can search. I'll probably include it in the link to the program. That episode that we did a few years back with Carl and Kate on where we do a deeper dive on this trust question. But that brings me to the next question, something that you brought up earlier. With having power, whether individually or as a company, and of course, in supply chain management, we've historically talked about the 800-pound gorillas, right, in industries, that leverage their power over others, right? So historically, it was Walmart in retail, and GM in automotive, and Apple in electronics, and you can say Amazon today in e-commerce. And you could almost say that we're seeing the kind of the same thing today in foreign relations and global trade, with kind of the US today kind of flexing its muscles against other countries. So some might argue that, hey, if you've got the leverage and you've got the power, right, why not use it? I mean, what would be your response to that?
So I'll give you a really good response with regards to GM, right? So GM, the US automakers versus the Japanese automakers. So that industry's been studied. Trust levels in that industry have been studied for over 20 years. So Professor John Hinckley, very famous study, he asked the suppliers to score the trust levels, on a scale of, I think it's 1 to 10, whatever. Are they trusting? Are they not trusting? GM's always at the bottom, right? Toyota's always at the top. Chrysler's in there. And so there was actually a Harvard Business Review article on Chrysler, and Chrysler had decided to be more like Toyota. We're going to build more collaborative relationships, longer term relationships. So they went to their suppliers and said, what do you like about doing work with Toyota? And they said, well, they don't just bid out our parts. We have this part for this car, and then we collaborate to drive down cost. So that's why we're cheaper. We can do the same thing for Toyota cheaper because we're working on the processes around what they're doing. It's a long term relationship. They're not bid out. So Chrysler's like, oh, okay, I'm going to do that. And you could start to see then in Hinckley's study, trust goes up. I'm not bidding you out. I'm not, we're looking at working on collaborating on reducing costs, not beating up on price. Well, then Daimler buys Chrysler. Game over, right? Sorry. And so here's why we're such huge fans of formal relational contracts, because all that good stuff, that relationship stuff that Chrysler did with the suppliers was outside the contract. The contract still had a 30-day termination for convenience. So Daimler comes in, it's like, bid it out. Suppliers are like, I just made all this investment. Now the suppliers are left holding the bag. trust goes down. And in Hinke's study, he shows that Chrysler lost $12 billion in
Wow.
lost innovation, in lost profits from working that way. It's a great supply chain management review article that profiles that. And I would say that you can use power and you're going to win all day long. So if you're a gorilla, the suppliers are elephants. They remember, right? And it's like whack-a-mole. You whack over here, it comes back over here, right? And I've been on the buy side, I've been on the sell side, I've been on the consulting side. So I've seen all facets of this game. And then now I'm at the academic side and I can look in at this game and you can see this dysfunction, right? And so suppliers, you whack over here, trust me, they need to get their profit. That profit is going someplace else. And we actually had a joke. I call it the P to price factor. We had clients and we're like, oh, we have to have the P to price index. You're a pain in the ass. You cost more time and energy and effort, right? I'm going to have to raise my price for you, right? And so it comes back. And so why aren't we just taking a step back and saying, why don't we work on optimizing our supply chain instead of functional silos, us versus them? It happens within companies too. Functional silo to functional silo to functional silo. So, now in the last 3 years or so, we've had people trying to look and say, I need to apply vested within my functional silos. My company's a three-headed monster. I've got operations, finance, legal, procurement. They are not on the same page. And so what vested does is it teaches alignment. Alignment of interest through win-win. There's five rules that, when applied, align the interest and change how you're working out of that transactional treadmill.
Now, would you say that, because we've talked, that's another thing we talk a lot about in this industry, right? The functional silos that you just brought up. Would you say if you're going to pilot this, or one area that you could pilot this is internally, it's kind of like lower risk, if you will, maybe, I've always heard, logistics people and salespeople, right? Sales is making promises that logistics can't keep and so forth. Maybe work. One of the best examples that I saw was where sales and logistics worked together, where they actually viewed logistics as a competitive differentiator and not as a cost factor. And logistics came up with ideas of ways that they can deliver more consistently within a tighter time window if they only receive certain, if they were able to receive certain information that they can then plan more effectively. And they were able to offer a lower price and meet the customer's, on time and full commitment by kind of collaborating like this. So sales was able to use their logistics expertise and capabilities and know-how and their infrastructure, their warehouses, that their network to position themselves against their competitors to say, hey, look, we sell similar products. But we can support your promotions faster at a lower cost. We can turn on a dime, right? So if you need, if all of a sudden you're running a promotion or sales are increasing more than you expected, we've got the ability to do that. But the only reason they were able to do that was because they collaborated together, and sales was able to talk the language of logistics in front of the customer, and then logistics, because they educated the sales folks. They weren't promising anything that they didn't know that they could execute. So it was a win-win all around. It was a win for logistics, it was a win for sales, and obviously it was a win for the customer. So anyway, I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, do you see examples of focusing vested internally first and then going out the outside, or it's across the board?
It's interesting. In 2010, our book was called Vested Outsourcing. In 2013, we dropped the word outsourcing. So vested, how P&G, McDonald's, and Microsoft are redefining winning in business relationships, because so many don't really think about outsourcing. We covered, for example, Water for People, and it's an NGO, and how they're partnering in different countries in different ways. They still follow the rules. And so the more that we've distanced, vested from outsourcing, which was our roots, To let's align interest, I am absolutely getting tons of keynote speaking requests to talk about how do we just collaborate and align interest. I just did an event for a software company, actually a software company in the supply chain space. And it was all about their internal organization. So we came in and we looked at the five rules. So I talked about the rules, and then each function got to score how the company followed the rules and where other functions cheated on the rules for their function, right? So, gosh, I'm in sales, but the development people, aren't helping be for flexible. I need this tweak in the software, and they don't really care because that's in the last generation. But I've got this big account that's screaming, and they're not working together. Or I've got sales trying to get my next sale, and I've got marketing over here is trying to get data. And they're like, who cares about data? That's just work. I don't care. Right. And so they got to put elephants in the room with other functions. And it was a kind of a fun way to do this. Right. So it's like, where are we cheating on these rules? And they're like, I think we cheat over here. And so they made a list. They had their top 10 list of initiatives where they wanted to collaborate better and follow the rules. And so I am absolutely seeing that. And you could argue Island Health and the doctors, that's internal, right? They're your doctors, they're your employees. And so I actually do see, I think that you're going to start to see unions. There's just so much tension in the unions today that I think you're going to start to see people go, you know what, we just have to stop the madness. Because in deals where the outsourcing relationship has been vested and the supplier has unions, they've changed the way they're thinking with the unions because they've brought that culture and it's been very successful. And so I've written a couple of articles poking on the United Auto Workers, the port strikes. And you look at the history, for example, the port strikes, each strike gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right? The United Auto Workers has a history of all of their strikes. Here's this, right? And it's just like, I up you, I up you, I up you, right? And so it's a classic example of tit for tat. You behave bad, I'm going to behave. If I lost in that last one, you just wait till the economy comes around, I'm going to get you.
Exactly. And we saw that obviously with the latest round of the port negotiations, which again was very adversarial, and it's always both sides trying to win versus trying to creating a how to get to we, if you will, between the two parties. We're running out of time here, so I've got a couple of more a couple of quick questions. For those of you watching, hopefully you've been asking questions all along, but feel free to keep asking your questions. So as a way to wrap up, two more questions. One, are there specific warning signs that indicate a business relationship, like let's say like a 3PL shipper relationship, could benefit from a vested transformation, right? So, I mean, what are the kind of the warning signs or the red flags to say, hey, like some of the cases you talked about, to say maybe it's not me, maybe it's, I mean, maybe it's not them, maybe it's me, maybe we need to rethink the way we're working together here.
Yeah, so I use analogy of a watermelon scorecard. You've got good metrics. It's green on the outside, but red on the inside. So anytime you're saying you want innovation, you say you want a strategic supplier, you say it's risky. Business is dynamic, right? So complex. So those are the types of words: complex, dynamic, risky, strategic, innovation, optimization. When you're feeling those kinds of things, that's usually a good sign that vested is right for you. We actually have, and over the years, you came to that very, very, very first class. We now have 10 classes in our Certified Architect program, three of which are free. And so one of them is called Is Vested Right for You? And we have a whole book, this one, Strategic Sourcing a New Economy. It introduced the concept of sourcing business model theory. So there's seven sourcing business models. Some things should be transactional. P&G has 80,000 suppliers. They can't all be strategic and complex and need innovation, right? So when you start to see those words, there's actually a tool that we use. It's an open source tool. It's in the Creative Commons. there's 25 factors, and you go through and you start asking yourself these factors like risk and dependency, and it'll point you to which business model is the right business model. So if you're not certain, just start digging in. Three classes are free. The vested orientation class free. 25 white paper, 25 case studies. We have 30 white papers. So if you don't want to read a book on strategic sourcing a new economy, go to our research library and you can download the Cliff Notes white paper version. Or go to Supply Chain Management Review. I've got an article on Supply Chain Management Review about sourcing business models. So just start Googling and see what's interesting. And the more you read, the more you start to realize this isn't just a nice thing to say. It's rooted in research. The HBR article, Harvard, Oliver Hart, Nobel Prize winning economic theorist from Harvard, collaborating with us on contract theory and relational contracts. We don't make this stuff up. It works. And so just be curious, start to read, just Google a little bit, Google Kate Vitasic, Google Vested, and see where your journey takes you.
So you've got vestedway.com, right? And that's where a lot of folks can find, a lot of these resources that you just talked about. So I think that's a great way to get started, as you said. I love what you just said there. Be curious. I mean, really be curious about this, and the fact that this is not just theory. I mean, you've got all these great case studies, 15 plus years of history already. Some great examples there, a lot of lessons learned, and obviously it's expanded so much from the very beginning, like you said, the 10 modules, and there's a lot of free resources out there that folks can tap into. So Kate, we're running we're bumping up on the hour here, so I just want to thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. I mean, I know these days you are often on the road, giving keynote addresses. You're very popular out on, as I mentioned before, in terms of meeting with either at conferences or meeting with business executives, really helping them understand more about vested business relationships and all that. So if people want to contact you, obviously LinkedIn is one channel. Where else can they go?
Yeah, so you can reach me at the University of Tennessee, but my email address is really tough there. So I have a cheater one. So it's kate@vestedway.com. Much easier than spelling out my University of Tennessee one. Both will get me there. But Google me, LinkedIn, I'm easy to find.
You're
So
easy to find.
Kate at Vested Way. Be curious. And as I say, change the world one deal at a time. Someone asked me, you've been doing this for 15 years, what's next? And I'm like, 15 years more of the same stuff, right? Do you know how many bad deals are out there? We have to change.
That's right. That's right. Well, Kate, always a pleasure. Definitely want to have you back in the program in the not too distant future. And again, thank you all for joining us today and attending this special edition of Talking Logistics on LinkedIn, and hopefully we'll see you in a future episode. So have a great day.
Awesome. Thanks so much.